It is exactly 3 p.m. This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial. Hope you're enjoying the 9/11 programming here today. And going to kick off here with a little bit of music from Dave Rovix. And in about 4 minutes, I'll be back with Paul Thompson and Mark Rabinowitz.
Hit in New York City, and thousands now are dead. It was Arab terrorists, this is what you said. Well, if that is the truth, then what have you got to hide? What were you doing on the day all those people died? Where the fuck were the fighter jets ordered by the FAA? What is your explanation for what you were heard to say when you told the Air Force to stand down, not to intercept? Did you plan to let it happen, or are you just inept? There's some distressing information, sir, which I think should be explained. Just which things have been lost, and just what has been gained. Like the thousands of put options bought days before the crash. If the money were collected, it'd make quite a pretty stash. And the only stocks they bought were American and United. Deutsche Bank knows the answer, but the names have not been cited. And is it just coincidence that this firm in the private sector was once run by Buzzy Krongard, now CIA director? And I am left to wonder, as the flames are rising higher, was this our latest Lusitania, or another Reichstag fire? There's something fishy in Virginia, and I want an explanation. Why did they get the contract? What is Britannia Aviation? A one-man operation, corporation with no history. He said he worked in Florida, but there he was a mystery. So is there a connection? I think it bears investigation. When the FAA found box cutters, does this cause you consternation? Hidden behind the seats in these Delta planes that had been fixed in Lynchburg with Britannia at the reins. And I am left to wonder, as the flames are rising higher, was this our latest Lusitania, or another Reichstag fire? You said Bin Laden was your friend, but he isn't in war. Now that he's not fighting Russia in your proxy war, who called the FBI off the Bin Laden family trail when so many times you had the chance to rewrite the sordid tale? Sudan in 96, the Taliban in 2001 offered to turn him over, and right then you could have won. But perhaps it is the case that you're avoiding victory, that to justify your exploits you must have an enemy. And I am left to wonder, as the flames are rising higher, was this our latest Lusitania, or another Reichstag fire? If you were not hiding from the truth, then you'd have a truth commission, not some masquerade kangaroo investigation hiring Henry Kissinger, the ancient master of deceit, to make sure all stones are left unturned and the rules are kept complete. Now you carry out your plans, which you have had for decades, conquering the world with your troops and bombing raids. I see an evil regime led by an evil man on Pennsylvania Avenue, where this evil war began. And I am left to wonder, as the flames are rising higher, was this our latest Lusitania, or another Reichstag fire? We'll be right back.
That was a little bit of music there from Dave Rovix. That was Reichstag Fire, which will relate very nicely here to the next hour of programming on KBOO's 2003 9/11 coverage. And just excuse the squeaking chair. We're having it fixed someday. My name is Andrew Geller. I'm going to be your host for the next hour here. And I have a couple of guests that will hopefully inform you, kind of hopefully make you angry, and spur you to do something about what's going on regarding the 9/11 investigation, etc. And just talking to folks about this. I have first Paul Thompson. Paul works with the Center for Cooperative Research and created the 9/11 timeline, which, as far as I've been able to determine, is the most comprehensive and documented collection of news reports, which paints a vastly different picture of what happened 2 years ago today than looking at individual mainstream media reports. Additionally, I have Mark Rabinowitz on the line. Mark is active on a variety of peace and livability issues in Eugene, Oregon, and he's also been very involved in the Deception Dollar campaign. Websites relevant to the two of these folks directly are www.cooperativeresearch.org and www.oilempire.us. Welcome to both of you, Paul and Mark.
Hi. Hello.
Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. I know that you guys are busy here on this day. So I'm interested in talking about things that most people don't really want to talk about regarding 9/11. And I'm not talking about, like, you know, you know, what happened in terms of, well, I am talking about what happened in terms of the air response and all that. But first, want to just put the idea out there that we're not going to debate whether or not the Bush administration knew that the attacks were coming. That's a given. It's beyond debate in my mind, and I assume in both of yours?
I wouldn't say that 100%, but I would say that if I were a betting man, I would definitely bet the money there.
Okay.
My take on it would be...
Oh, good God. Let's see. Who's still with us?
This is Mark here.
Okay, Mark, you keep talking. I'm going to go get Paul right back.
My take on it is that using a reasonable doubt standard that's used in a court of law, there is no question that the Bush administration knew the attacks were coming and that the Air Force did not follow long-standing procedures that have been developed over decades to deal with such circumstances.
You know what? Keep going here, because I just I'm having a complication with Paul's cell phone. One of the things that I specifically want to bring up, and we might as well just jump into it now as we're ad-libbing at this point, is there were a series of exercises that were taking place on September 11th, 2001, and not just one. There was a CIA exercise happening, there was a National Reconnaissance Office operation happening, and a NORAD, which is the North American Air Defense people, and responsible for airspace across the North American continent, they were all having exercises that were remarkably similar to the actual events that took place on 9/11. Can you just discuss a little bit about what these exercises were doing to the best of your knowledge and how the exercises are kind of being used as cover for the administration saying, oh, well, we didn't know really what was going on because there were these exercises happening?
Well, with the NORAD exercise, which was called Vigilant Guardian, a mainstream news service, the Newhouse News Service, which is corporate media, ran an article a couple months afterwards interviewing mid-level officials with NORAD. They were running an exercise on how to do response to an imaginary crisis. And one of the people interviewed in the story said that when they got the phone call from the FAA saying almost a half hour after the first plane went off course, they thought that the, quote, it must be part of the exercise. At first, everybody did. And it's been hypothesized that this exercise was timed very curiously in terms of what actually happened that day, that they're planning for a major incident, and then it suddenly materializes. A more fishy war game was done by the CIA and the National Reconnaissance Office also that same day, where they were simulating a plane into building scenario at the NRO headquarters in Virginia, which is just a couple miles from Dulles Airport. And then, imagine that. There was a real plane into building scenario going on, and so they canceled the exercise. However, the war games doesn't quite explain. It could possibly explain why the air defense didn't scramble early enough to protect the people in New York City, but it doesn't explain what happened after 9:03 when the second tower was hit and the Pentagon was hit more than a half hour later. There are a number of Air Force bases surrounding the Washington, D.C. area, most notably Andrews Air Force Base, which is about 10 miles from the Pentagon. And planes were not scrambled out of Andrews until after the attacks were complete.
Okay, I'm trying to multitask here. Paul called back, but I was trying to call him back, and we're just having problems. So we'll get him back in a second or so. So these other exercises, which, you know, for people who are now thinking, oh yeah, right, okay, sure. Right. Well, there were these simultaneous exercises. Okay, right. Well, the Associated Press, you know, that radical news service, reported on this. I've got a copy of the article back home in my files. I know that you have things about this in your files too. And you know, it's a real thing. And let's kind of segue into the idea of, you know, why the basically a stand down was ordered at some point along the lines, which delayed the response. And you can maybe incorporate the idea of, you know, people didn't know what they were doing because there was confusion and et cetera. And let me see if this is Paul calling back here. Can you talk about the idea of a stand down?
Well, a stand down is a military term for when military forces are kept from responding or acting in some way. And there's overwhelming evidence that the Air Force did not follow its own procedures. They do not need, for example, presidential authorization to send up fighter planes to investigate an emergency situation. They do need presidential authorization to shoot down a plane, but they do not need any authorization from anybody to scramble fighter planes and investigate what's going on, especially if they've had warnings from a dozen different countries that something like this is coming. When Pentagon officials the day before canceled flight plans, we know that from Newsweek magazine. When you have a variety of officials, including the mayor of San Francisco, being warned not to fly that day, that was from the San Francisco Chronicle. And you even had huge amounts of insider trading betting that the value of United and American stock would decrease dramatically. This was done a couple days before the attacks. So between these and many other warnings that this was coming, and the fact that they were doing war games, simulating these types of events, there is no plausible explanation other than a stand down that makes any sense for the lack of a response that morning.
I just want to mention that we now have Paul Thompson back on the line from the Center for Cooperative Research. Paul, Mark's been discussing the exercises the NRO, NORAD, and CIA had in place and underway on 9/11 2 years ago, and how those are being used somewhat as cover for what I'm more than happy to say was an official stand-down order by the military, because they claimed they didn't know what was real and what wasn't. Do you have anything to add to those ideas about that?
He made some good points there. I'd also mention, I find very interesting that Salman Rushdie was given a warning not to fly during that week. And that's also from a very reputable paper, I think, London Times.
Well, and the curious...
And you can see why they wouldn't want him to fly, because had he happened to have been on one of the airplanes, that would have been a huge complication in terms of his whole reputation as being having a fatwa on his head.
Right. Well, and the interesting thing about it, and it wasn't a warning not to fly. My understanding is he was forbidden. He was banned from U.S. airlines.
Yeah, he was banned from flying, and interestingly, he was only banned from flying domestically,
right?
Which is very important because the official excuse is to say that they had some idea something was happening, but they thought that it would happen overseas. Whereas from that warning, you could see they knew that something was going to be happening domestically.
Yeah, very, very true. That's you know, and one of the things that I'm finding really interesting, not having kept up on this like day to day over the course of the past couple years, but keeping abreast of things, is the contradictions that are coming out between the initial responses, especially from official agencies like NORAD, at the time and in the weeks after the attacks 2 years ago, to the testimony that's now coming out in the independent commission reports, that the testimonies and the hearings that have been happening. Hey, Paul, is that your cell phone?
I'm having a really hard time hearing you, actually. Let me switch phones, and I'll give you a call back.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, well, this is what happens when sometimes you're on cell phones and traveling. So we will, you know, hope for the best and get a better signal with Paul there. And I don't think that's him. Oh, wait. Yeah, that is him. All right. Let's see if that's there. And nope, that's not him. Okay. Well, anyway, how much have you been keeping up on the independent commission hearings, Mark, and noting these discrepancies between, you know, say the official NORAD timeline and now what they're saying a year and a half later?
Well, the first response I would have is that it's not an independent commission in any way, shape, or form.
Accepted.
This is an official government body that the Bush administration spent about a year stonewalling on and trying to keep it from happening. And the only reason it even came into existence is a number of the relatives of some of the people who died that day, who were killed that day, wouldn't take no for an answer. And they basically shamed the Congress and the administration into doing this. You may remember that the commission's original chair picked last fall was the Dr. Henry Kissinger, who should be the subject of an investigation instead of leading one, most notably for the other September 11, 1973 in Chile, which is a whole other conversation, but I assume most KBOO listeners are aware of what the U.S. government did to Chilean democracy 30 years ago today.
Well, and I'll just mention here real quickly that from 4 to 5 this afternoon, following this conversation with Paul and Mark, we're going to have a taped segment all about September 11th, 1973, and the overthrow of Allende. So, just for people's knowledge.
Now, the
current... I could also add about Chile. There was something coming out in the paper the other day, how the CIA was sponsoring terrorist acts in Chile. New documents reveal a campaign of terror against the Chilean people. So you can see a parallel there in method between that and 9/11.
Yeah, very much so.
Well, one thing I would add about the current commission, though, bringing it back to 911, is Kissinger's replacement is the former governor of New Jersey, Thomas Kean, K-E-A-N. And he has not been as controversial, but in some ways he has even more blatant conflicts of interest than Dr. Henry. Kean is on the board of Amerada Hess Petroleum Company, which until very recently was invested in a Saudi consortium which is involved in planning for an oil and gas pipeline across Afghanistan. In other words, the chair of the so-called independent 911 commission is a business partner of Osama's brother-in-law, and even Fortune magazine wrote an article on this several months ago called 5 Degrees of Osama. And yet, this should be front page news everywhere, and it just goes down the memory hole.
Yeah, it seems to be the trend with a lot of this stuff. So, I mean, I have my own ideas about what some of the most important things to talk about in the context of, you know, things people don't want to know about 9/11, but I'd like to hear if either of you has something that you really very much want to talk about that, you know, doesn't relate to the stand down or the other exercises or, you know, the physical location, for instance, say, of the FAA hijack coordinator and the head of NORAD, General Ralph Eberhard, who is now in charge of the Northern Command, which I recently learned and thought it was fascinating that those two people theoretically occupied the same kind of general office space at NORAD, and there's talk about, you know, them having been the so-called bottleneck and why communications didn't get to where they needed to go to get the response out in time.
Well, if I could mention something tangentially related, I think it's very important, this recent discussion in England having to do with Michael Meacher, I believe is how you pronounce his name.
Right, the former environment minister for the Blair government.
Yeah, he has been a long-time politician over there. He's been in and out of the British cabinet for the past 20 years. He just resigned from the Blair cabinet 3 months ago, and he's still a member of parliament. And he came out with this article in The Guardian, one of the biggest papers over there, just a couple days ago, openly accusing Bush and Blair of having foreknowledge of 9/11 and letting it happen and having a bogus war on terror to further their own agendas. And he talks about the stand-down issue, the delay in response. He talks about a project for New American Century, which is a whole other interesting topic. But the fact that here's somebody who was, you know, working with Blair in the cabinet up until a couple months ago, coming out with this stuff, shows that I think over time that these ideas are going to become more and more mainstream. But also, none of that has been reported in the U.S. It's been big news in Britain, no reporting about Michael Meacher in the U.S. at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's you know, it's only so many times you can have the same conversation about, oh, we heard about this in foreign press, but not over here, and you know, figuring out how to shift that is a real tricky one, and thank goodness there's independent media like this radio station where, you know, we can talk about anything we want because it's the listeners we're responsible to, and we don't have, you know, people trying to sell you dish soap. Something that I found really fascinating that I read just last night was that with the recent power blackout back east in mid-August, this is from a Washington Post article, August 15. Quote, in the first minutes after yesterday's power blackout, the Pentagon launched two Air Force F-16 fighter jets to patrol skies between New York and Washington and put other military aircraft on alert at eastern U.S. bases, defense officials said, end quote. So, you know, every single instance where there's been a concern about either planes going off course or other related activities, I mean, the idea that the power blackout had anything to do with a plane going off course, you know, it's they just don't connect. But here, you know, they're getting these fighters up and off the ground in 5-6 minutes. And the only day that I've ever been able to find where there was an actual problem with an airplane and the FAA regulations regarding hijack procedures, emergency and hijack procedures, which are automatic and need no approval, was 2 years ago today. Have either of you been able to find out another instance where fighter jets were not launched when the emergency regulations kicked in?
If I could answer that, not where they're not launched, but I think it's interesting that we know that they were launched quite a lot before 9/11. Because you could say about this power blackout that, you know, things have changed after 9/11.
Right.
But, for instance, in the 9 months before 9/11, we know that fighters were scrambled for various reasons 67 times in the continental U.S. So it wasn't like this is some completely unheard-of procedure. If a plane goes off course, there was a famous case with one golfer, Payne Stewart, and his plane went off course year or two before 9/11, and fighters scrambled, and there were newspaper articles about that. It's very standard procedure. And in fact, NORAD guarantees, and they recently said this in their testimony, that they can get a plane up within 15 minutes in any circumstance, 24 hours a day with weapons. And if we look at the time, you know, you could argue that maybe 5 minutes or 10 minutes if they're really on the ball, but let's say 15 minutes. You look at the actual times of how long it took to get some of the planes up. In some cases, we're talking nearly an hour after the, you know, the planes should have been up. So there's something clearly very wrong from what the normal procedure is.
And in fact, the FAA regulations, I'm quoting from an article you wrote, Paul, a while back, regarding the defense or the lack thereof of the skies on 9/11 2 years ago. FAA regulations actually say that if you are in doubt that a situation constitutes an emergency or potential emergency, handle it like an emergency. So they're saying even if you're not really sure, just run with it. And if it turns out to be nothing, so much the better.
Yeah, but what I think is also really interesting, if you move away from the day of 9/11 itself a little bit, is the fact that they were getting so many warnings before 9/11. And yet, they seemingly did absolutely nothing to boost security. The official story is that there were 14 planes guarding the entire continental U.S. on the day of 9/11. Seven bases with two planes each. But we know from before that time that there were lots of warnings about hijacked planes, about hijackers going to take planes, crash them into prominent buildings. There's something like a dozen foreign governments warning the U.S., very specific warnings. For instance, Egypt said there were 20 people in the U.S. training on small planes, planning to use them. Incredible numbers of warnings, even naming some of the hijackers by name. And yet, there are no security procedure changes during those months.
Well, now that's mostly true for the American public, but it's not necessarily true for some of the so-called leaders in the federal government. Because I believe it was, again, that article about the failure to defend the skies that you referenced, Paul. The hotel that George Bush stayed in the night before 9/11 actually had anti-aircraft missiles on the roof of the building, and it's common knowledge now that at the G8 meeting a couple 3 months beforehand in Genoa, Italy, that there were anti-aircraft batteries kind of around the city because of threats they'd received, and George W. Bush actually even spent the night on a U.S. military aircraft carrier because of concerns for his security.
Yeah, that's true. There's also John Ashcroft stopped mm-hmm. flying on commercial planes in July, and he wouldn't say why.
Well, and since then, last year, he actually apparently walked out of his office at some point when he was questioned about why he stopped flying domestic aircraft, which I think is really very interesting.
Exactly.
You know, why? What's so dangerous about answering that question? So let's kind of begin to move a little bit more towards some of the possible ideas behind all of why this happened. And before we do that, I just want to mention for folks that they're listening to KBOO Radio. My name's Andrew Geller, and I'm talking both with Paul Thompson from the Center for Cooperative Research, who created the 9/11 timeline. And you can find out more about that at www.cooperativeresearch.org. And Mark Rabinowitz, who's been involved in many issues down in the Eugene, Oregon area, and he's involved in the Deception Dollar campaign. And his website is at www.oilempire.us. And let's move towards talking a little bit about the idea of oil and empire, and a concept that many people may not really be all that familiar with, which is peak oil. Can you explain a little bit about what peak oil is, Mark, and how you think that it factors into what happened a couple years ago and just kind of in general the Bush administration foreign policy?
Well, let me kind of give the Cliff Notes version of this. Most people, if they think about it, realize that there's a finite amount of petroleum available for civilization to extract and burn and put in our machines and get use out of. Here in Oregon, we all understand that the days of logging the giant old-growth trees are nearly at an end because most of them are gone. It's not the best analogy with peak oil because trees do sort of grow back and oil does not. But most of the petroleum geologists in the world who have looked at this have come to the conclusion that we are either near or at the all-time peak of petroleum production. nature or God or Allah or whatever you believe in provided 2 trillion barrels of oil. Barrels, 42 gallons of oil. We have burned about 1 trillion of them. There's about 1 trillion left to go. And most of what is remaining is in the Persian Gulf area. Saudi Arabia is about a quarter. Iraq's 10%. Kuwait's about the same. Iran and a couple of other states also about the same. The United States reached its peak of oil production or extraction in 1970. And in the decades to come, as oil production begins to decline, the Middle East will end up being more and more important to control of the world economy.
I'd also like to mention Western Africa, because there's a significant supply of oil there, and some people are thinking that we're about to become extremely interested in Western Africa as well.
Well, but the big prize is still the Persian Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of discussion a few years ago about the Caspian Sea and former Soviet Central Asia, and there's oil there, but not nearly as much as originally hoped for. And as a result, the Persian Gulf area is of prime importance to control of the global economy. And our country seems to have made a quiet decision that rather than figure out how we can use the remaining oil as a bridge towards a renewable energy society, for example, we could use some of the oil to make solar panels and windmills and relocalize some of the production that we've been spreading all over the world so that communities are more self-reliant. They have decided on the military approach, which is to invade the oil fields and control them, and then the U.S. would have its hand on the spigot. Western Europe has very little oil, for example. There's some in the North Sea, but in 20 years, that will be mostly gone.
Well, and Japan has basically none.
Japan doesn't have any. China has some, but they're becoming more dependent on imports as well. And so what we're beginning to see is a scramble for the last of the oil. And this is something that even a liberal Democrat or a Green, if they were to take power as president, would not be able to affect much at all. There's the old joke of the bank robber who was asked, why do you rob banks? And he said, well, that's where the money is.
Mm-hmm.
Why did we invade Iraq? That's where the oil is. And it's been estimated that the last 2 barrels of oil in the world will be Saudi and Iraqi.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way that 9-1-1 fits into this is that an open policy of aggression and empire to take over the Middle East oil fields wouldn't be very popular in our country, let alone the rest of the world, without some sort of excuse. And if you look at the history of war, lots of wars have been preceded by some sort of incident, whether real or contrived, in order to gain the pretext for war. For example, here in Eugene, our most famous politician was Senator Wayne Morse, who was one of the 2 senators to vote against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in 1964. It was a completely staged incident. There was no attack by Vietnam on our ships, but that was used to get the blank check for the Vietnam War. And because of that deception, 58,000 Americans and 2 million Vietnamese were killed in a pointless, useless war.
Well,
I could also point out, just prior to the Gulf of Tonkin, 1962, there was the Operation Northwoods,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a very interesting parallel to today. Because I imagine both of you are familiar with that, but essentially the Joint Chiefs of Staff came to President Kennedy and said, we want to stage a bunch of terror incidents in the United States on the American people so that we can go to war with Cuba. Of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis was happening around then, and there was a great desire to go to war with Cuba. Luckily, Kennedy turned it down, but we have all these documents now, and it's been very mainstream. There's an ABC News story about it. So you can see the motive there to have terrorist incidents on a domestic population in order to go to war with another country.
And if I'm not mistaken, there was the idea of actually either shooting down commercial passenger jets or actually using them as weapons themselves back in the Northwoods documents.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. They were going to, I don't want to get into this, there's a controversial remote control theory that the planes were remote controlled, but it's interesting to note that even back in 1962, they were talking about remote controlling planes and crashing them that way.
Right. Right. Anything that you would like to add, Paul, about the concept of oil and how it fits into kind of the American empire plans and maybe the project for a new American century?
Well, I don't really talk about oil, peak oil, much in the timeline, but I have to say that I think it's a very interesting idea and certainly has a lot of merit. I think perhaps the folks in the White House were thinking about Afghanistan in terms of oil back in 2001, and that has a lot to do with the invasion of Afghanistan. And as Mark was saying, since then, it seems like they've realized there isn't really much oil there, and so their interest in Afghanistan has completely waned, and they're just letting it go to pot.
And hoping people forget about it.
and focusing more on Iraq. But I think that there's a long history of negotiations that were going on with the Taliban there to try to get a pipeline through the country. That it's a complicated, long story, but I think that's a big part of what 9/11 was all about.
Well, and I think it makes sense to mention too that representatives of the Taliban, in fact, an entire delegation, visited then Governor Bush in Texas many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think you were going to say something, Mark.
Well, I was just going to add about Afghanistan that the other financial imperative is that the Taliban had shut down the opium production a little less than a year before September 11, and that removed perhaps $200 billion from the world financial system. And now that the Taliban has been overthrown, the opium production is back up to being number one in the world.
Well, and that a lot of that money, or all of it, is kind of like black dollars in the sense that it's not really accounted for in any sort of above board way. Mike Rupert, who unfortunately had to cancel and reschedule from this morning to later this month, talks a lot about drug money and its influence in not just the global financial markets, but actual government treasuries. You know, how, you know, the U.S. Treasury depends on drug money. But we can let Mike Rupert talk about that later this month with Pear. I think it's like the 25th or something. We'll announce it later.
Well, if I could also use that to bring up another topic, the drug connection in Afghanistan is, I mentioned earlier that I'm not 100% sure that what the U.S. role in 9/11 was. I think that with the stand down and so forth, that there's obviously somebody in the administration knew something. But I think it's also very interesting to look at the role of Pakistan in 9/11, the ISI, which is the Pakistani Intelligence Agency. They have a lot of hands on 9/11. And there's a long history of them and the CIA and the opium and heroin smuggling through Afghanistan, through Pakistan. You know, a lucrative multi-billion-dollar industry, and the CIA actually proudly says that in the 1980s they worked hand in hand with the ISI to get these drugs out of Afghanistan as part of a plan to dope up the Russian soldiers there. They don't deny that they were working hand in hand in drug trading at that time, which I think is a remarkable admission. And we see these connections, these ties between the ISI and the CIA going down to today. So I think, you know, for listeners out there, definitely something to keep an eye on is when you look at 9/11 is what was the role of Pakistan and the ties between drugs and 9/11. I think that's a untold story that we need to know a lot more about.
I'd like to add something to that as well. Is that the head of the Pakistani ISI, which is their equivalent of the CIA, was in Washington, D.C. on September 11, 2001, meeting with the House and Senate so-called intelligence committees. What were they talking about? It would have been fascinating to have a transcript of their breakfast meeting that the head of the Pakistan Secret Service just happened to be in D.C. when that happened. And one of the people that he was meeting with was Senator Bob Graham, Democrat, now running for president, who admits that he was in Pakistan just before September 11.
And it's kind of widely known that the chief of the Pakistani ISI is the one that sent $100,000 to Mohammed Atta, who's considered to be the kind of ringleader of the planning of all of this. And lots of strange webs.
Yeah, I would say, unfortunately, that's not widely known enough. There was a brief little article in the Wall Street Journal about that, of all places, but most people don't know that. There have been a couple other interesting revelations just in the past few weeks about Pakistan. There was a FBI agent testifying before Congress the other day who said that the money trail from 9/11, funding 9/11, goes back to Pakistan, but he wouldn't elaborate on that. But that fits in well with what we know about the head of the ISI ordering the money. And there is another revelation. There's a Al-Qaeda leader named Abu Zubaydah, I believe it was, and some revelation coming out that when he was captured by the U.S. in 2002, he had he told his interrogators names and phone numbers of important people in the Pakistani and Saudi government. And they went and they checked out, and they found that, those were real numbers and that this guy was in contact with all those people. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like, to me, I think a logical way to look at 9/11, to put it into perspective, is perhaps the U.S. or elements of the U.S. government farmed 9/11 out to the Pakistani government, to the ISI, who in turn involved Al-Qaeda in it. And that the Saudis were also involved, elements of the Saudis were involved in the financing. So you kind of get all kinds of hands involved in a very big, complicated operation, because we see evidence pointing to all these different factions. We see the U.S. connection, we see Pakistan, we see Saudi Arabia, and we see Al-Qaeda. So it's kind of all over the map.
Well, privatization is all the rage with the Bush crowd. I actually want to kind of shift the conversation a little away from some of kind of the hard documentable facts that are not as well known as they need to be, and focus on the idea that there's a lot of really important stuff about this that's not as well known as it should be. And I know that Mark is a little bit more up on this than I think Paul is, but it's the idea of gatekeepers among the so-called left, liberal, progressive community, both on kind of local levels and at a national level. Can you describe briefly, Mark, what your concerns are about the concept of left gatekeeping on the issue of 9/11 specifically?
Well, I'll try to do it by analogy. The deception dollar movement, which some KBOO listeners may be familiar with the 911 dollar bills passed out at the peace rallies last winter and numerous other locations. We have now printed up over 3 million of these, which have been passed out from coast to coast and in other countries as well. To the best of my knowledge, none of the, quote, left alternative, unquote, media, The Nation, Z, In These Times, Mother Jones, etc., have run any stories on this effort. And the questions that we've been discussing today, you will strain really hard to find any of them under discussion in the so-called liberal alternative media. Now, it's not a surprise that NPR or Fox News don't really want to touch these topics, but for The Nation magazine
or
Noam Chomsky to be defending the official point of view has really been more difficult to figure out.
You know, I've actually corresponded via email with Chomsky on a couple of points about what's going on with 9/11 and the responses I got, none of which were real recent, so he may have picked up more on this, but it was basically like he's not doing any sort of real digging on the controversial aspects of this and is kind of just not going along with the main stories about it, but, you know, he's somewhere in between, which, you know.
Well, he's an advocate of what I like to call the blowback theory, which is the official story of what happened that day, that it was a surprise attack from 19 guys taking the orders from the dialysis patient living in the cave, was correct, but that we were attacked not because of our freedoms, but because we have a violent foreign policy that has angered people in that part of the world. And there's an element of truth in that, because the genesis of the 911 attack, the U.S. government found out about it in 1995, and that clearly was blowback. But Chomsky is very good within certain parameters, but when it comes to describing some of the modus operandi of the empire, for example, Chomsky still takes the position that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman in Dallas,
mm-hmm.
which makes me wonder, well, they have a physics department at MIT. I mean, he could go and talk to them and realize why it's just not physically possible for that to be anywhere close to the truth. And exactly why this is the case is hard to say. I think there's a certain peer pressure campaign in our society not to look at these things. There's cognitive dissonance and fear. And with a couple of the liberal publications, they take some money from some right-wing foundations that have oil and covert ties, like the Ford Foundation or the Rockefellers. And you know, that's where community-supported radio can be free of such manipulations.
You have anything to add to that specifically, Paul?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with, when you talk about gatekeeping, I think a lot of it has to do with the phrase conspiracy theory, and that has become such a red flag, and that has been such a charged word that when somebody says conspiracy theory, people think X-Files and UFOs and all this stuff. And I think a lot of people on the left are trying to, maintain some of, what they consider a legitimacy, respectability, and anything that smacks of conspiracy theory, they're afraid of, because they think that, oh, this will marginalize us, nobody will respect us, and so they avoid it like a plague. And that term has been used so effectively. I mean, one interesting example was a month or two before this latest Gulf War, Tony Blair said that anyone who says that this Iraq situation has anything to do with oil is talking about a conspiracy theory, which I just find absurd. It's so obvious, the oil connection. But you just throw that term out, and people, run for cover.
Yeah. So any ideas on, the timeline, anyone who doubts any of this stuff can go and check out the timeline. The entire thing is hypertext linked, footnoted, and you can go to the source material and you can find, the vast majority of the points made have corroboration from three or more sources. And we're not talking about like kind of the fringe radical independent media people who, it's six folks talking in a room and they're trying to figure all this stuff out. This is like Washington Post, New York Times, major European press and Asian press and wire services that a lot of this stuff is cross corroborated on. So any ideas on how, to kind of break through, because the mainstream media doesn't seem like they're interested in kind of putting the pictures together. They'll run individual reports that fill in the picture. But it's really the independent media and, you'd hope the independent alternative left liberal media that would kind of pick this up and run with it. So any ideas on what it might take to get, the nation interested or Utney, or do you think that there's really just no hope because it's been 2 years and they're still not interested?
Well, if I could answer that, I think you can look at the parallels with the JFK assassination, where nowadays something 80%+ of people think that there was a conspiracy there. But the problem with that was it took 20, 30 years mm-hmm. for people to come to that conclusion when it had largely ceased to be politically relevant. It became more like a parlor game to figure out who done it. And I think that the same thing is going to happen to 9/11 by and by. In fact, Senator Bob Graham even said, we won't really know the true perpetrators behind 9/11 until 20 or 30 years from now when more documents are released, which is a pretty staggering thing to say in and of itself. And the challenge that I think we have to face, all of us, is how we can move that time frame forward. So instead of waiting 20 or 30 years to find out the truth, we can find out the truth now while it's still,
makes a difference.
Right.
Before the 2004 election, especially,
right.
You know, people need to know this. They need to know what they're voting for when they're going to be voting in 2004. And I see some hopeful signs lately. I think the situation with Iraq, people are starting to draw into question some of the assumptions that they've been having and are starting to look at things a bit more critically. Bush's polls are dropping a lot. But I think that it's going to take more for people to be even considering to look into some of these issues. I mean, your radio listeners may be disagree, but most people are not really wanting to look at. It's like a can of worms that they just don't want to open. And there's a lot of psychological resistance to looking at the whole 9/11 question. And overseas, people are a lot more open-minded about it. Germany, a new poll in Germany came out a week or two ago saying that half of all young people in Germany now think that the U.S. government was behind 9/11. Because they're getting very different information in the media than what we're being told.
Can you just elaborate quickly on a couple of points that are making the German public think that the government here actually participated in the attacks?
I didn't quite hear you there, but I think there's been a, like I said, different coverage. There's a show, for instance, on the German version of PBS, their public TV station, that came out like a month ago that openly made the suggestion that the U.S. was behind 9/11 and presented a lot of information to that effect. Can you imagine PBS in the U.S. doing the same? I can't imagine that.
No, I certainly can't. What I had asked was any specifics that leap to mind that the German public is aware of about U.S. complicity that people here may not have heard about? Anything that just kind of leaps out of your head?
Well, one interesting article in Der Spiegel, which is one of probably the biggest newspaper in Germany, talked about a specific warning that the Mossad gave, the Israeli intelligence agency gave to the U.S. They gave the U.S. Apparently a list of 19 hijackers, named the four hijacking leaders, told them that, you know, what the plan was, and that story came out in the BBC, did a piece on it, a couple other sources in Europe did a piece on that, and never got reported to a single source in the U.S. So how could a person in the U.S. know that incredible bit of information unless they're, you know, reading Der Spiegel? Or unless, I think, you know, talking about how to get the information out, I think the internet can be perhaps the key piece here. You know, I'm trying to put this stuff on the internet, and I'm hoping that that's one way to get past some of these gatekeepers and bottlenecks.
Anything to add to that, Mark?
Well, I'd tie it into the song you played at the beginning of the hour called Reichstag Fire, and I've been astounded that even a lot of peace activists are not that familiar with the history of fascism in the 20th century, and that when Hitler came to power in 1933, the Nazis burned down the Reichstag, the parliament, in Berlin, blamed it on the communists, and used it as the excuse for a temporary suspension of civil liberties, and of course that temporary suspension lasted 12 years. And my guess is that in Germany, especially among the youth, they're much more conscious of abuses of power given their history that they have to deal with. And you also have the case where there have been some, there's a former German minister named, minister in the government named Andreas von Bülow, I think is his name.
Mm-hmm.
And he's written about the U.S. being complicit in what happened. And look what happened to Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of Georgia when she dared to just even ask a few tentative questions on this. She was pilloried. The Democrats dropped her like a hot potato, and the Democrats and the Republicans colluded to have her lose her congressional seat. So there's a huge resistance to this, but at the same time, around the time of the invasion of Iraq, the British newspapers reported a huge surge and increase in their traffic on their websites coming from the United States,
mm-hmm.
because lots and lots of people here realized they weren't getting the story from the U.S. press. and they were looking to see what publications in other countries were saying.
Well,
via
now,
the internet.
With that concept in mind, I'm just going to read a short quote here from someone that we all know, not personally, but probably don't agree with on many things, and then I'll thank you guys for being involved here. This quote is from Dr. Joseph Goebbels, who was the Nazi Minister for People's Enlightenment and Propaganda. Quote, "The lie can be maintained only for such time as the state can shield the people from the political, economic, and/or military consequences of the lie. It thus becomes vitally important for the state to use all of its powers to repress dissent, for the truth is the mortal enemy of the lie, and thus, by extension, the truth becomes the greatest enemy of the state." And I think that sentiment could be expressed, that could have been said by, well, let's see, what's the Minister of Propaganda in the Bush administration? I suppose maybe Ashcroft.
Fox News?
Yeah, I mean, there's too many choices to limit it. I would like to thank both of you very much for joining us here on KBOO's 2003 Special 9/11 coverage. Paul Thompson works with the Center for Cooperative Research and created the 9/11 timeline. You can find all that and several... let's dial that down a little. And you can find out about the 9/11 timeline and many others online at www.cooperativeresearch.org. And Mark Rabinowitz is active on a wide variety of peace and livability issues in Eugene, Oregon, as well as the Deception Dollar Campaign. He has a website at www.oilempire.us. Thanks very much to both of you for joining KBOO today.
Thanks for having us. And thanks to KBOO for being courageous independent media.
All right. Well, thanks. Okay, so that's going to wrap up this hour here. I am going to put up a bunch of website links for people who are interested in finding out more. They will be on the People Rise Up homepage, which you can get to from kboo.fm and click on the program schedule, and then Wednesday morning at 10 for People Rise Up. Just real quickly, a couple of those are, these are all beginning www. There is standdown.net. There is questionsquestions.net, and there is whatreallyhappened.net. I think it's .org, but it could be .com. So I'm going to go out with a little bit more music from Dave Rovics. I want to make mention that the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Department has a whole bunch of stuff happening from 6 until 9 tonight. At 5 o'clock will be the regular one-hour KBOO Evening News. A bunch of live reports from Cancun at the WTO Ministerial and some updates on negotiations. And coming up next at 4, there are two short programs about the coup in Chile, the other well-known recent September 11th in history, that being 1973. Today is the 30th anniversary of the CIA-sponsored coup against the democratically elected government in Chile. Those next programs will feature, among others, Isabel Allende and Ariel Dorfman, as well as some historic sound recordings and music. And let's see, if I can get all this just working right, we'll have a little bit of music. And again, keep your radio tuned in here to KBOO for all sorts of great stuff the rest of today and every day. Thanks again for tuning in.
International terrorists are scheming. They want to bring the planet to its knees. They're hiding in their bunkers, and they're plotting with bombs and guns and biological disease. Any means to reach their ends is worth pursuing. If lives are lost, then that's the way it goes. It's the game of world domination. The stakes are high, as everybody knows. And the international terrorists are flying in their jets, trying to find the city to hit today. For all of the injustice in the world, they're gonna make somebody pay. They'll make sure their people will support them through the use of their powerful cartel. If you are to prosper, this is their decision, whether you will starve or else live well. And the international terrorists are busy trying to win your heart and mind. They're making news and writing press releases so that you can have your thoughts defined. And they say that they're the voice of reason, and they want to make the world free. And they will vilify, disappear, and torture anyone who would dare disagree. International terrorists are many, every color, size, and shape and height. Some are only small and local bullies, content to bomb a building in the night, while some are in each pocket of the world, looking for a country to attack. They're training in their bases somewhere near you, and they're flying in the skies above Iraq. The IMF is the name of their cartel, and CNN's their propaganda arm. And if they don't brainwash and starve you into line, they'll make damn sure all your people come to harm. They'll decimate and carpet bomb your country with a million mercenaries and machines, striking fear into the people of the world, the U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines.